This is TLV1.
The Tel Aviv Review.
Hello and welcome to the Tel Aviv Review, a program dedicated to the word, to the thought, and to debate, brought to you by the Van Leer Jerusalem Institute, which promotes humanistic, democratic, and liberal values in the social discourse in Israel, and the Israel Institute, enhancing knowledge and study of modern Israel. I'm your host, Gilad Halpern, and today I'm honored to have three distinguished guests who are behind a new art installation called Four Times Sally, which was recently on display at the Van Leer Institute. The protagonist is Salomon Sally Perel, a German Jew who, as a teenager, while trying to flee the Nazis, masqueraded as a Gentile and ended up joining the Hitler Youth. His remarkable story was dramatized in the Golden Globe-winning film Europa, Europa, that remains to this day my absolute favorite Holocaust movie. Sally Perel, welcome to the Tel Aviv Review.
Shalom.
Also joining me are two artists, one Israeli and one Austrian, who transformed Sally's story into a video installation containing four interviews with him, two in Hebrew and two in German. Two are as himself and two are as Jupp, his Nazi alter ego. Shimon Lev and Friedman Der Schmidt, welcome to the Tel Aviv Review.
Hi.
So, Sally, we have to start by giving our listeners a bit of background. Can you tell us, your story is remarkable and very intricate, but if you can take us briefly through it and tell us, how does a Jewish teenager in the 1930s become a Nazi?
What's special about my story is that I didn't experience the Holocaust among Jews. That's unlike most survivors. I was never in a ghetto or a concentration camp. I experienced the Holocaust among the Nazis. I spent 4 years in their midst, living in a Hitler Youth boarding school, being a member of the Hitler Youth. How it all started, how I ended up there, is a story I can tell chronologically. I was born in Germany, and when I was 8 years old, Hitler came to power. When I was 10, my family left Germany for a neighboring country, Poland. We settled in Lodz, Poland's second largest city. I hardly saw Poland as my home. I barely learned the Polish language. One day, our world fell apart again. On the 1st of September 1939, Germany invaded Poland and conquered it within a few days. 4 months later, the occupation forces ordered the Jews of Lodz to move into the ghetto. My parents felt that if you go into the ghetto, you wouldn't come out alive. That's why they decided to send me, I was already 14, together with my 30-year-old brother Isaac, not to the ghetto, but to eastern Poland, which had been invaded by the Soviet Red Army as per the Nazi-Soviet pact that stipulated the division of Poland. It was time to say goodbye. It was clear to my parents that it was for good, that we would never see each other again. To me, by the way, it wasn't so clear. But I'd like to repeat the last words my parents told me, because until this day, they mean a lot to me. My father, a very religious man, had one final request: always stay a Jew, always believe in God, and God will always cherish you. And my mother complimented him: go, for you must live. With these words, I left my parents' home together with my brother. After an arduous journey, we reached eastern Poland. As a child refugee, the Soviets admitted me to a Soviet orphanage where the schooling was socialist. I was taught the socialist ideology. I spent 2 years there. 2 years later, on the 22nd of June 1941, Germany invaded the Soviet Union in the so-called Operation Barbarossa. All of us, the children and the teachers, started moving eastward to a city called Minsk, but the Germans caught up with us, together with all the other refugees. We had to form a line to register and be sent away. Why did we have to register? Because the Germans had an order not to take Jews as prisoners, because they claimed that every Jew is a carrier of the bug of Bolshevism and bugs must be exterminated. When I heard that, I naturally joined the longest line. I slowly moved forward, all shaken up. I was 16, my mind stopped working, but my instinct still worked. At some point, before I reached the desk, I dug a small hole in the ground with my heel and buried my documents in it. I moved another few steps forward and suddenly heard an order, "Hands up!" My turn came. I see a German soldier before me and he asks, "Are you Jewish?" The first thing I thought about was my father. He told me, "Always remain a Jew." But to my great fortune, it was clear to me that if I said I was Jewish, I would be dead within 5 minutes. It was clear to me that I was facing a fatal decision. What's more important, religion or life? That was my decision. It seemed to me then, instinctively, that the right to life supersedes any form of religion or creed. In my opinion, and this is what I've always believed, there is no cause that would justify sacrificing human lives, especially of young people. It isn't good to die for something, it's good to live for something. And at that moment of embarrassment, I heard my mother's voice, "You must live," and the fear dissipated. I even smiled to the German and answered with extreme confidence, "No, of course I'm not a Jew. I'm a German national. A Volksdeutsche, an ethnic German." And miraculously, he believed me. Lying saved my life. In other words, it's okay to lie to save lives. Not only life is more important than religion, also, even though lying is immoral, to save lives, it's okay to lie. They gave me their uniform, and I was shocked to see a swastika with an eagle figurine on my chest. I was a translator from Russian to German. I joined the unit and reached the outskirts of Moscow with them. The whole journey, I had all sorts of experiences with them, but there is a specific one I'd like to point out. As a circumcised Jew, I couldn't allow myself to be irresponsible and shower in their presence. So one day, I waited for them to finish. It was a very hot summer. You had to shower. I was alone in the kitchen of a Russian farmer. Just as I finished taking off my clothes, our medical officer attacked me from behind. He had always sought my company and I had heard a lot of sweet talk from him, but I never obliged. Suddenly he attacked me, held me close, And then I was shocked to realize that he was trying, what he was trying to do to my body. I fought against his attempted rape as hard as I could and let myself loose of his grip. He stood in front of me, turned beetroot red, and noticed I was circumcised. He said, "Yup, that was my nickname. Yup, you are a Jew." I couldn't deny it. I burst into tears because I was sure he would bring over his revolver and shoot me. Why am I telling this story? Because he and I shared a human experience. First, he told me to keep quiet so that nobody would hear us. He then told me he would do me no harm and said another thing that struck a chord with me. There is a different Germany. And we became friends. He never touched me again. If he had tried again, I don't know how I would have reacted. He was later killed in battle near Leningrad. And there was another German officer who mentored me, but winter came in the meantime. The German offensive, the Blitzkrieg, failed, and he decided to send me back to Germany to a Hilter Youth boarding school to be educated in the spirit of National Socialism and the imminent victory. That's how I ended up in a Hitler Youth boarding school. What happened later is an odyssey of experiences no fiction writer could come up with. So this is how I ended up there.
You said that you lived as a Nazi for 4 years.
Yes.
During these 4 years, did you feel in danger nonstop? Or did you let yourself go sometimes?
Of course, but...
Were you constantly on alert?
First of all, I developed strong defense mechanisms that controlled me. I became an observer of the events of my own life. I never planned anything. I wasn't thinking in the evening what the next day would look like. I let everything run by itself and could adapt myself to the dangers that may emerge. These defense mechanisms led me not only to forget that I was a Jew, but also to enlist as a bona fide Hitler Youth. I identified with a Nazi ideology as a result of the brainwashing that I underwent together with my peers, weeks, months, years of brainwashing. The Jews were to blame for everything. I started forgetting I was a Jew and started hating myself as a Jew. That is, I became my own enemy.
Even when you took your clothes off, you were never reminded of the fact that you were Jewish. You never thought about your parents.
Only at night the memories came back. I lived a reality that I would call schizoid. During the day, I was a fervent Hitler Youth, wanted Germany to win. And at night, I was weeping, thinking about my mother, father, and sister, who remained in the ghetto. The next day, again in uniform, marching and flying the Nazi flag, I was a Hitler Youth again.
Shimon, this schizophrenia that Sally is talking about is really what you were interested in, coming up with this idea, right?
Yeah, I think it needs some background. Friedman and me, we're doing quite for the last few years a project we call Two Family Archives, like which actually it's... checking the limitation or the possibility of the extension of the dialogue between all my family. The larger family perished in the Holocaust, and Friedman Wittel, but he's coming from a Nazi background family, and we did this project. So actually two narratives or two family archive or family history was already there, but we have been working for 4 years about it, and now when Friedman came with the idea of working with Sally, it's actually going another step and going forward another step, because actually Sally represents what we are doing that, but in the same person.
Exactly. That's what's remarkable about Sally is that the two narratives are in the same person. So, Shimon, you said that you started working on this True Family Archive before Sally came along. Where did the idea to combine Sally's story or incorporate it into your project came from?
Look, as Shimon already pointed out, so we did all kind of also experimental projects, like on the basis of art-based strategies, in order to better understand the situation of the other one. So, for example, we tried to change, to slip into each other's skin. But, you know, very fast you are getting to the limitations of it, and you learn very toughly how much you are determined by the background of your family history, of the society you're living in. And I got the book of Sally, which actually he was writing something he didn't know, but it was sent to me by a place that had us and had Sally a month later. And when I read the book, I knew about the story, but there was one sentence that really struck me. It was the sentence where Sally said, and after 1945, Joseph didn't want to leave. He became a real person because he writes that it was not possible to play a role like an actor. So this struck me, and we met like a half a year later. I also sent Sally my book about my part of the family research, and we met, and then we asked him, Sally, is it technically possible to talk to Joseph and to Solomon separately? So that's how it came.
So it was possible to talk to the two separately. Did you have to work on it a lot until it was, you know, to flesh it out, or did it come out naturally?
First of all, we used as a helping tool also the language, and you can even make it more broad, to go far from the dichotomy, because now we have four interviews. We have like two Sallys, but you can also think about, is the German Jew Solomon identical with the Hebrew Shlomo? Or is the German Joseph identical with the Joseph that speaks Hebrew and lives in Israel already for decades? But in order to open the interviews, we started like this, that Shimon talked 1 hour to Shlomo in Hebrew, then we had a coffee, and after the coffee, I talked 1 hour to Joseph, and only 1 week later, we changed it around. But I think this, first of all, it was different partners to talk to him, and also the switch of the language.
Sally, did Joseph live in you all that time? How difficult was it to start thinking as Joseph again, more than 70 years after?
He has remained a part of my life. At moments, he's dominant again. He's present to that extent. It depends on the stimulation. If, for example, I see a swastika in a movie, Yup comes to life. When I see Nazi soldiers marching in a documentary, Yup marches with them. And then I become nostalgic. I once took part in this victory match. I was on my way to help establish the 1,000-year Reich. I feel some sort of pride. And then Sally comes forth and chases it away.
When was the first time after the war that you had a moment to reflect on what happened? Because I'm assuming that when you lived it, it didn't quite register how remarkably unusual your story is. When did the first click?
In fact, right after the war ended, I walked down the street in Germany to claim my ration stamps at City Hall. Suddenly I see a man coming towards me in a striped outfit. I still didn't know it was a concentration camp uniform, but I saw a yellow star that said Jude on it. I walked past him, but turned back after a few steps. Something in me realized I had some connection to the Jews. I thought I was a Jew too. And there was another one. I was confused. I went up to him, stood before him and asked, "Excuse me, are you a Jew?" He didn't even give me a second look, because I was still in uniform. I only removed the swastikas, of course, but the traces were still visible. He just ignored me and walked past me like I didn't exist. I was really offended. I wanted him to believe me, to persuade him we were one. And then I blurted two words I hadn't even realized I knew. I told him in an Ashkenazi pronunciation, Shema Yisrael. And then he looked at me, and I told him my name was Salomon Perel, and that I was Jewish. And he was persuaded I was telling the truth, and we hugged each other in the middle of the street and were crying like little children. The German bystanders witnessed a crazy scene. A Hitler youth and a concentration camp survivor hugging each other and crying. I will never forget that moment. It was the first push toward the return of Salomon, which continues to this day. In fact, as long as Yup lives in me, I am not the same Salomon who left his parents' home and probably never will be either. But the first push was the encounter with a man in the striped outfit.
Who was the first person you told your story to?
He was the first person I told my story to. I explained to him why I was wearing a uniform.
Were the people who didn't believe you when you told them your
story? By the way, he has died, but I'm still in touch with his wife. They lived in Antwerp. He was a Jew. His name was Manfred Frankel, and he was the person who helped me start my return to being Solomon. I didn't know it would take so long, because I didn't realize how attached I was to Yup, to the extent that I can't get rid of him. Maybe I don't want to, because I love him. Here is a conflict for you, a Jewish man in love with a Hitler youth. You can write a whole book about it.
Or create an art installation. Shimon, I wanted to ask you, do you think that the two identities can somehow be separated? The two histories that were so conflictual at the time, and still are in many ways, forever bound together?
I would put it like this, as an artist or also kind of, dealing with hobbyist project, as Friedemann would say, we were also interested in, let's say, more conceptual questions, like the question of language, when you tell your story, like the framework of the story is the same, but in each language and in each point of view, like Sally or Yup, and he emphasized different aspects. So actually, and especially in the case of Sally, to understand his story, you cannot do it only with one story. That, I think, is the main point. I mean, the same person can be different stories, and there is also the fact that, Sally is telling this story many times. So, and this, I think, for him, it was the first experiment to tell the same story, but from different aspects, and not to usually, like, probably, when somebody give lectures, so he get used to it, so obviously it's influence. So this was part of it. And also, of course, the question of narrative. I mean, Sally didn't talk about it, but his story is so extraordinary that I think it was very difficult for people to believe in it. And only when you hear the two points of view and the two languages, you can start to understand the extraordinary of this story.
As you call it, it's a synoptic portrait of Sally. It is funny because, Friedman, you don't speak Hebrew, and Shimon, you don't speak German, right? Do you feel that there was like a gap that somehow prevented the two aspects of your two contributions to this project from fully coming together?
Actually, I think it's very universal. This is a very extreme case of biography. But if you think about, each person is probably a mother, but also a daughter, but a colleague, but a working mate. So usually each person has more than one personalities. So from this point of view, the research on it, in order to see the differences and to make a much more three-dimensional picture. I think in case of Sully, what struck me so much was he describing this tension. He said schizophrenia, but I think, as I pointed out before, it's less schizophrenia. It's like this, you know, these different aspects of one person. And to deal with it, it helps to make it visible, to show it to yourself. So actually we started in a project that we did between each other, like a mirror situation, like Shimon was me and I was Shimon, but we actually didn't make the text in advance. We just improvised after 1.5 years of being together, working on the topic. So it's full of mistakes because I don't know the story of Shimon so deeply as I thought, and the opposite. So we were both suffering hearing the other one giving our text.
Sally, on this point, I want to ask you, what about your family? How do they live with that psychological burden? I mean, having, as you said it, a schizophrenic father, grandfather.
My children didn't know. I didn't know how to tell them. It wasn't clear to me who I was, what it was, whether I was a victim or a criminal, or both. And besides, don't forget that after the war, I came to Israel and was bent on building a new life. In order to build a new life, I had to forget my past, to create new energies for the future. If I had spent every day thinking about my Holocaust, my story about my mom and dad who perished, about my sister, about the Hitler Youth and my Nazi self, I would have ended up in a madhouse. So the silence also helped me recover.
And when did you break the silence?
When I retired and had a heart surgery, that was the breaking point. I told my wife, before I entered the OR, if I live, I'm going to write a book, I told her. It's a shame to take this story with me to the grave. So I wrote the book without knowing it would become a movie and an immensely successful one to boot. Only yesterday I received a letter from New York from a group of students who saw it and said, I must come to meet them in New York. This movie lives on, and so does the book. There are books that are forgotten the minute they're written. My book is being studied in schools. Some students are tested on it. It's very satisfying and adds a certain dimension to my survival, the fact that I pass it on to the next generations.
That is incredibly inspirational, and I would like to thank all three of you, Salomon, Sally Perel, Friedman Derschmidt, and Shimon Lev. Thank you very much for coming on the Tel Aviv Review and telling us about your art installation, Four Times Sally. And also big thanks to Gizem Ozdemir, our sound engineer, and to the Van Leer Institute and the Israel Institute for their generous support. If you like this podcast, there are many more where it came from. Just go to www.tlv1.fm/podcasts and take your pick. Co-host Dalia Shandlin will be back with us shortly, but in the meantime, do visit our website, like us on Facebook. Our page is called the Tel Aviv Review Podcast Ideas from Israel, and follow me on Twitter. Join us again next week for another edition of the Tel Aviv Review, and until then, goodbye.